heard a story once of a football coach who enlisted the help of a former player in to help him with recruiting efforts. And so the player came along and joined with the coach and said, "Coach, what kind of players are we looking for? Who are we supposed to be recruiting here?" And the coach sat him down and said, "Listen, do you know the player that when he gets out on the field, he gets knocked down and he stays down? He just slinks off the field and he's done. He can't go anymore. You know that player?" And the athlete said, "Yes, yeah, I know who you're talking about." He says, "We don't want that kind of player, do we, coach?" He said, No, we don't want that kind of player." He says, "But tell me, do you know the player who when he gets knocked down, he gets back up again? And then he gets knocked down again, and he keeps getting up, and you can't keep him down. He just keeps getting up." And the helper said, Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. That's the kind of player we want, isn't it, coach?" The coach said, No, that's not the player we want." Well, the athlete was pretty confused. He said, Well, coach, what do you mean? What kind of player do we want then?" And the coach says, "I want the guy who's knocking everybody else down. That's who we want on our football team." And I guess if you're forming a football team, that is what you want, right? The guy who's knocking everybody else down. But I think that has also infused into our society. That kind of outlook is rewarded. The person who knocks everybody else down. In fact, that's the clearest and fastest way to the top, is to be the person who just knocks everybody else down to get ahead. Winning becomes the only virtue. General George Patton, who served in the Second World War, he was known as a pretty vulgar person, but he once said this: "America loves a winner and will not tolerate a loser." America loves a winner, will not tolerate a loser. And so in our American mindset, who do I have to knock down to get ahead? And we all know this is true, that there are those people who, they'll knock down anybody. People will take advantage of you. They'll swindle you. They'll cheat you if it means they get ahead. And that's the kind of attitude that leads to exploitation and injustice. The strong oppress the weak. The rich walk all over the poor. And then when the roles are reversed, the poor rise up and oppress the oppressors. People cheat and take advantage of one another. And this is the way it's done, we're told. This is how you get along. And if you don't play along, you're going to get left behind. Or perhaps if you don't exploit others, well, you may as well just count yourself as a victim. And if we look back at human history really is a sad tale, a record of human injustice. And as I said a few moments ago, more often than not, that's rewarded rather than reprimanded. The rich and powerful allowed to get away with hurting others just because of their status. They keep on knocking others down. But the truth is, they don't really get away with it. Because God will judge injustice. God will judge injustice. And that is really what James has to tell us here in James chapter 5. God will, in fact, judge injustice. And that should come as both a warning and an encouragement to us. It should be a warning for those who try to knock others down. A warning to those who would practice injustice: beware, God sees and God knows. But secondly, it should be an encouragement to those of us who suffer injustice. Why? Because God sees and God knows. Well, the original readers in the book of James would have belonged to that second group, those who were mistreated, not to those who were oppressing. And the first 12 verses of chapter 5 really deal with this matter of encouragement for those who are suffering or who are mistreated. In fact, if we look at all of James chapter 5, I see that there's three main admonitions that close the book. First of all, in verses 1 through 12, it is persevere. Persevere. In verses 13 all the way to 17, or excuse me, 18, the admonition is pray. And then in verses 18 and 19... 19 and 20, the admonition is pursue. That is, pursue fellow believers who are trapped. So, persevere, pray, and pursue. That's where we're going here in James chapter 5. But again, it begins in verse 1. And if we look at the first six verses, we're not going to take all 12 together. We're going to break it into two halves. But the first six verses address the rich, the oppressors. And you may have noticed in our scripture reading this morning, it's a pretty heavy passage. Let me read it again, starting in verse 1. It says, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have laid up treasure in the last days. Behold, the wages of the labor who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you." These are very hard and somber words from the Lord addressed here to the rich. There's a couple of things we need to consider before we dive into this passage. First of all, we need to consider who James is writing to. I believe that James here is denouncing the injustice of unbelievers. Now, some people will look at this passage and say, how can he be talking to unbelievers? It's got to be Christians he's talking to here, because unbelievers never would have read this letter. They never would have heard this. So what's the point of James condemning the rich who are outside the church? Because they'll never read or hear this message. And that's not a bad point. But I think James is speaking here, not to those in the church, but to those who are the ungodly outside the church. And I think he's doing it for a couple reasons. First of all, to encourage the saints. You know, this message isn't for them. They're not the rich who are oppressing. But it's a reminder that those who are oppressing them will not get away with it. Secondly, I think, and this is important, James is speaking here the language of the Old Testament prophets. James is speaking the language of the Old Testament prophets here. And oftentimes, in the Old Testament prophets, they would speak to the other nations. Yeah, a lot of their message was directed to Jerusalem and Judah and to Israel. But sometimes they would address Babylon or Egypt or Assyria. And part of that method, you know, again, the Assyrians and the Egyptians are likely never to read Isaiah's prophecy. But he speaks to them nevertheless. And I think James is doing kind of the same thing here. He's using the language of Old Testament prophets. In fact, I have four or five examples here, but just listen to one. This is from Isaiah chapter 10, 1 through 4. See if this sounds at all like what we just read in James. Isaiah 10, 1 to 4. "Woe to those who decree iniquitous decrees, and to the writers who keep writing oppression, to turn aside the needy from justice, who rob the poor of my people from their right, that widows may be their spoil, that they may make the fatherless their prey. What will you do on the day of punishment, in the ruin that will come from afar? To whom will you flee for help, and from where will you leave your wealth? Nothing remains but to crouch among the prisoners or fall among the slain, for in all this his anger has not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still." Again, it's this sort of thundering denunciation from the prophet. And that's very much what we find in James chapter 5. So I think James is doing much the same thing that the prophets were, speaking to those outside the assembly of God's people, yet with clear prophetic warning. And what's the message? God will judge injustice. So let's get a clear perspective of this here in James chapter 5. And I've broken it down into two main headings. First of all, we're going to look at the reprobation of the heartless rich. And then second, we're going to look at the reason for their harsh judgment. So let's begin with the reprobation of the heartless rich. Now, when I use that word reprobation or reprobate, here's what Merriam-Webster's dictionary says. It means to condemn strongly as unworthy, unacceptable, or evil. To condemn strongly. That's exactly what James is doing here. He's condemning these heartless rich. And he begins here in verse 1. He says, "Come now." That's an invitation. It's the same expression, by the way, we saw back in chapter 4, verse 13. There, James had said, "Come now, you who say." And he talked about the presumptuous planner, the person who thought they had their life all mapped out. And now he says, "Come now, you rich. I want to turn the attention to you. And I want you to consider your ways." Now, he speaks here to the rich. And some people have looked at this passage and said to themselves, well, James just doesn't like rich people. Or the Bible itself condemns riches. Well, that simply isn't true. There are actually very many godly men in the Bible who were very wealthy. People like David and Solomon and Abraham. Even in the New Testament, you have people like Joseph of Arimathea, who was a very wealthy man, but devout in following the Lord. So it's not a blanket condemnation of riches that the Bible speaks to. But we ought to recognize there's something about riches that creates quite a temptation for folks. I mean, even as ordinary Americans, there's something repulsive and yet attractive about extravagant wealth. Joy was sharing with me about her trip to Rhode Island and talking about the Vanderbilt homes there. There's actually several, and I didn't realize that they had multiple summer cottages there and in Newport. And she was telling me about going to Marble House, which apparently, I don't know if it's the foyer or the dining room, but it's gilded. I mean, quite literally. They talk about the Gilded Age. Well, this, I mean, she showed me a photo of it, and there's gold covering all kinds of stuff. And we look at that and we say, man, these people were filthy rich. Doesn't it kind of disgust you, these displays of extravagance? And yet, there's something in us that's willing to pay $50 to go visit the Biltmore Estate, right? So we're sort of attracted to it, but we're also repulsed by it. And, you know, the Vanderbilts, they built, also in Newport, is the Breakers, which is a very modest cottage. It's about 138,000 square feet and 70 rooms, you know, very modest. And we feel a kind of disgust about that kind of opulence. But the Bible does not categorically condemn riches. In fact, if we go back to James chapter 1, verses 9 through 11, it says there, "You rich, exalt in your humiliation." It doesn't say, rich, give up your money, give away your wealth. But it does say you need to look at your life not as a great, mighty person who hasn't made, but you need to look at your life as somebody who is on equal footing with even the lowest person. Exalt in your humiliation, that you are no better or worse than any other human being before the Lord. So the Bible does warn the rich here, but not because they're rich, it's because of their injustice. So it says, "Come now, you rich." Here's the instruction. Here's the command. "Weep and howl." That's pretty graphic, interesting language that he uses here, right? Weep and howl. The word weep means to sob aloud. This was what was done for the dead back at this time. In John chapter 11, we're told that people came to the tomb of Lazarus and they were weeping. Same term. To cry aloud in anguish. And then it's heightened with the next word, weep and howl. Howl indicates a cry of personal anguish, like pain. It could also be translated shriek. Think of the word shriek. We don't use that very often, but when you do, it's probably like a shriek of terror. I think that's what James is getting at. Weep and cry out in terror because something terrible is coming. And indeed, the rich oppressors had better be warned because there is a grievous future ahead for them. Now, they've been holding on to their wealth. That's their primary characteristic. They're called the rich here. But James points out some things about their riches that they should keep in mind. First of all, he says, your riches will not spare you from coming miseries. Your riches will not spare you from coming miseries. He says in verse 1, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl." Why? For the miseries that are coming upon you. Miseries. This term here refers to disaster, calamity, but also to wretchedness. So there's something awful and debasing that's coming their way. And he says, your riches are not going to spare you from that. Weep and howl because there is misery ahead for you. They were living it for the moment with no thought of what was happening next. You know, again, these rich are oppressing others. They're propagators of injustice. And so they think they've got it made. They think they're looking out for their interests. James says, watch out. There are miseries ahead. And if you're not careful, and if you don't change your ways, then you will be swept away by them. Miseries are coming. A man was once given a tour. I don't know if it was the Vanderbilts, but he was given a tour of a large nobleman's house, you know, extremely ornate and wonderful. And so the owner asked this man who was getting the tour, he said, what do you think of the place? Trying to draw out some kind of compliment from him. And he replied, all of this with heaven would be noble. But he said, all of this and hell would be terrible. So what he was trying to hint at was, what matters is the future, our future dwelling, not this home. It'd be great to have a nice fancy home and be headed for heaven, but woe to the one who has the fancy home, yet hell is in his future. And we think about these terms, howl and weep and miseries. It certainly reminds us of what Jesus taught about the coming judgment. He said there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth when this life ends, and those who have turned away from God and who have broken his commandments, there is a terrible future. And no amount of riches can spare you from that. Secondly, James teaches that this man's riches will expire. Your riches will expire. He says in verse 2, your riches have rotted and your garments are moth-eaten. And then he goes on in verse 3, your gold and silver have corroded. In other words, the wealth, the things that you have built up for yourself, they're going to be gone. Now, he says your riches have rotted. He's probably talking there about the riches in terms of the harvest. So again, most of these landowners, rich landowners, a lot of their wealth was tied up in their crops and their fields. So they would harvest, they'd have these big barns full of grain. We might think of it today like silos full of grain. And James says, it's going to rot in there. Instead of you getting to use it, it's going to rot. And then he says, your garments will be moth-eaten. Again, there were several ways in ancient times that you could show that you were wealthy. You could go out and spend a lot of money. You could party and eat really well, or you could dress really well. Those were all ways of showing that you were extremely wealthy. By the way, not much has changed, has it? But the rich would oftentimes have many sets of clothes. The poor, or even the average person in Bible times, only owned one, maybe two changes of clothes. And so the clothes you wore every day. You would take them off to wash them, and then you would put them back on. And so most people, if you were wearing your clothes every day, yeah, you would wear them out, but there wasn't much danger of them being moth-eaten. The rich, however, they had closets full of clothes. They couldn't wear them all. And so, you know, one day the rich goes to his closet and decides, you know what, I'm going to pull out a garment I haven't worn in a while, and pulls it out, and these little moths have laid their eggs, and the larvae eat up the garment. And that's the fate of the rich. Again, the poor don't have to worry about moth-eaten clothes because they don't have enough clothes to eat. The rich, however, he says, your wealth's going to expire. You have all these changes of clothes, but they're going to be eaten by moths. Again, very reminiscent of what Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount, right? He said, don't store up treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, but store up treasures in heaven. Well, here the moth and the rust destroy. I thought about this in terms of modern parallels. This is kind of like what we do when you fill a box full of clothes and you leave it in the attic or in the garage or in the shed or maybe in a storage unit. And then you come back later and it turns out, you know, water has gotten in. And the box is all moldy and ruined. Well, that's what the rich here are finding. We have so much stuff and yet it's all going to expire. It does me no good. And then he says in verse 3, your gold and silver have corroded, which some people have pointed to problem here, that gold and silver don't corrode. So what's James mean? Well, in Bible times, you had gold and silver coins. Those were the currency. But it was very rarely pure silver or gold. There would be mixed with other alloys like iron. And so even though the gold and the silver may remain intact, the other metals that were part of that coin would corrode. And it would be kind of like what you see today with our pennies, right? You have a shiny new penny. Well, I guess there aren't any new pennies, but a nice shiny penny. And then you'll find some that are corroded. Like you can't even hardly tell. It's just this green lump. Well, that's what would happen to their money as well. So here he's got this big, you know, Scrooge McDuck vault full of gold, and yet it corrodes and is worthless. The point is, riches expire. And trusting in riches is never a good choice. And we can look at all kinds of modern-day examples of this where people have trusted in riches, and yet they expire. Third, though, he points out your riches will not only expire, they will testify against you. You'll see this in verse 3. He says, your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you. Now, it's interesting. He says that the corrosion itself will be evidence. In other words, I think what he's getting at is what you see happening to these coins where they're eaten up and they're broken down by this process. He says, the same thing is going to happen to you. You're going to be broken down in these miseries that are coming. But I think the hoarded wealth here is also evidence of their greed and their injustice. If they had treated their workers right, that money would have been given out and would have been used. Instead, it sits there and it corrodes. It's stockpiled to satisfy their own greed instead of being used to help. Now, this doesn't mean it's a sin to save money. But to hoard riches at other people's expense, especially when those riches are extracted from those in need, that is injustice. I think we should picture here in all of this the final judgment. In fact, he says here in verse 3, it's going to be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. What an awful picture this is. Again, talking about the future judgment, Jesus says it will be defined by and described by fire. He says, the fire is going to consume, or the corrosion is going to consume your flesh like fire. It's a graphic, disgusting image. But that's the point James is trying to make. Great are the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches will testify against you. And then fourth, your riches will fuel your punishment. As it says here, it will eat your flesh. Horrifying image. Homer Kent writes, the fires of judgment will be fueled by this corrupted wealth. And how have they been treating this wealth? It says they've been laying up treasures in the last days. The end of verse 3. You have laid up treasures. By the way, you see the connection? Laid up treasures. Remember, I already mentioned Jesus said, don't lay up treasures where moth and rust destroy. So he's kind of using the similar terminology here to Jesus. But another way to translate this laid up is to hoard. Hoard money. And it says, by the way, they have laid up treasure in the last day. It doesn't say for the last day. Maybe some translations say that, but the idea is you've laid it up and it is the last day. What a foolish thing you have done. Here it is. The hour is late. And what are you doing? Hoarding money. Money that cannot help you. Somebody once used this illustration, saying that this man hoarding his money on the last day is sort of like a man living in the South at the end of the Civil War, and he's hoarding all of this Confederate money. He's got millions and millions of dollars in Confederate bills. But what he doesn't know is that in a few months, General Lee is going to surrender at Appomattox, and the war will be over, and all of that money will be absolutely worthless. Nevertheless, he goes around hoarding it, creating this stockpile of money. It's interesting. I actually read about a what's called the Richmond Hoard, appropriately named. And what it was a big wad, millions of dollars, I believe, in Confederate bills that were discovered. Somebody had tried to collect all these. And, of course, when the war ended, they were barely worth the paper they were written on. That's what we do. That's what the rich do when they stockpile money, not realizing it's the last day. See, judgment is coming. Now, we could look at the rich and say, man, they've got it made. They have everything they want. I wish I could be rich, too. Probably down deep in all of us, there's probably still that lingering desire that, you know, it would be nice to win the lottery. It'd be nice to suddenly be extremely wealthy and not have to worry about money ever again in my life. And we look at these rich and we say, man, I'd like to be like them. That's the same thing that Asaph was struggling with back in Psalm 73. I encourage you to go read it. I'm not going to read it this morning, but the first half of the psalm, he's saying, the unrighteous, the wicked, get away with everything. They have everything they want. They have it so good. But you see, what they don't have is a perspective of the future. That's why in verse 17 of Psalm 73, Asaph says, I almost despaired until I saw the end of the matter. In other words, I thought living for God is pointless when the rich get everything and injustice runs rampant. But then he says, I saw the end of the matter. I saw their end. And then I knew they really don't have it well. Weep and howl, you rich. Let us not envy those who have much and yet have much because they have mistreated others. They've heaped up not only treasures, but also have heaped up judgment for themselves on the last day. Now, if it's not riches that are the problem, why does James go to such extent to condemn the rich? What have they done that's so bad? Well, that's number two. We look at the reasons for their harsh judgment. The reasons for their harsh judgment. James spells out what these people have done that deserves this kind of denunciation. And it's not that it's just that they were rich. Again, I see this attitude sometimes. People just hate rich people because they're rich. I think there's a bit of jealousy mixed in there. That's not what James is saying. They're not evil because they're rich. They're evil because of what they did to acquire their riches and what they have done with their riches. So starting in verse 4, he lists three reasons why they are judged so harshly. And the first reason is they were guilty of defrauding. Guilty of defrauding others. Look at verse 4. Behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you. So he says, behold. Look, I'm going to show you what it is that brings such devastating judgment. And he says, the wages of the laborers cry out. And it says they mowed your fields. This doesn't mean they were landscaping, you know, like they were driving around on zero-turn mowers. No, this means that they were harvesting the fields of the rich. These were rich landowners who had vast tracts of land and would grow immense crops on them. And they didn't have enough workers to harvest the field, and so they would use what were called day laborers. If you want a picture of how this worked, go to Matthew chapter 20, verses 1 through 16. Jesus tells a parable about the day laborers. But basically what it means is there were people who worked day by day. I mean, subsisted on the money they could make in a single day. So what they would do is they would go down to the marketplace or to the agora or whatever, the, you know, city square, and they would stand around and wait for the landowners to come and recruit. And the landowner would come, hey, I need five guys on the field today. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you come with me. And they would go, and they would be paid. And a fair wage was about a denarius a day. And so that's how it would work. You know, people would stand around and hoping that a landowner would come and need help and would go work in the fields. These verses tell us quite a lot about James' audience, by the way. You know, James started his book by saying, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Well, one of the trials we know that they were facing was this life of being taken advantage of. You see, James is writing to dispersed believers who are far from their homes. And so one of the only ways they could make money was as day laborers. You know, I mean, some of them could have pursued a life as a merchant or something else, but a lot of them would end up as these day laborers, you know, hoping to find work in somebody's field. So they would be brought into the field and expect a wage for it. Well, look at what happens, verse 4. Behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your field, which you kept back by fraud. So these rich landowners didn't pay or at least didn't pay fairly, those who had worked in their fields. They were defrauding them. Now, how did they do that? Well, we don't know exactly. My guess is it probably looks something like this, because this is how it works today. The laborers come in from the field, and the landowner finds some nitpicky little thing to criticize and to thus as an excuse for not paying them. Oh, I see you didn't get quite to the edge of the field. You missed a little spot there, so I'm going to have to deduct your pay, you know, and take out some. So it may have been something like that, you know, which, again, still happens. You'll have people who, you know, order a big meal, and then something, one little thing is not to their satisfaction, so they try and get the whole meal comped. Or, you know, somebody will order something, and there'll be one tiny little defect on it, and they call in and demand that the order be free because there's some small problem. And so these landowners find some small thing to thus deny wages. Or here's another possibility. The workers come in, and the boss says, listen, you did good work today, but I don't have the cash on me. Come back tomorrow, I'll have the cash, I'll pay you. Okay, so the laborers come back the next day, and he says, well, if you want to get paid for yesterday, you need to work for today, too. And so it defers. And that was big, because these people depended upon that money to feed them that day. If they didn't get paid, they didn't eat. And so holding back the wages, if even for a day, was to defraud those day laborers. And the Bible says, the wages of those who you have defrauded are crying out against you. They're crying out. It's almost as if these wages themselves, you know, that he has stuffed into his pockets are screaming for justice. And by the way, this injustice was directly addressed in the Old Testament. It says in Leviticus 19, verse 13, it says, do not defraud your neighbor or rob him. Do not hold back the wages of a hired man overnight. I think that's exactly what these landowners were doing. But the wages cry out against them. That is to say, it comes before the Lord. This sin of defrauding the workers, it comes before the Lord. The wages cry out. That reminds me of several Old Testament passages. I can't go into all these. But certainly you remember in Genesis 4, verse 10, where it says the blood of Abel cried out from the ground to the Lord. Something similar here. The wages of those whom you have defrauded cries out. Furthermore, it says in Exodus chapter 2 that the Israelites, when they were mistreated and abused and suffered injustice in Egypt, it says that they cried out to the Lord and the Lord heard them. So God knows. He hears. The rich thinks, hey, they're poor, what can they do? Well, the Lord hears. Not only does it come before the Lord, it stirs up the Lord of armies. See this in verse 4? You've kept this back by fraud. It's crying out against you, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. Or maybe some versions will say, Lord Sabaoth. That's a little term we probably remember best from the hymn, A Mighty Fortress, Lord Sabaoth. It just means Lord of hosts, which means Lord of armies. It was actually a name of God that refers to his role as a warrior king for his people. One interesting study that I encourage you to do at some point in your life is take a look at the names of God. That's such a valuable study. Now, obviously, God is called God. He's called Lord. But also there's other names like Elroy, which means the God who sees, or Jehovah Jireh, the God who provides. And each of those names tell us something about God. Well, Lord Sabaoth, the Lord of armies, was sort of his military name. It's kind of like in our country, we have a president who we can call the chief executive, but when the president is working and functioning as a war leader, we usually refer to him as commander-in-chief. Well, this is the Lord's commander-in-chief name, Lord of hosts. So you see what he's saying here? The laborers whom you have defrauded, they cry out to the Lord, and the Lord who is powerful, the Lord who is mighty in war, who has great armies, he has heard. Tremble, you rich. So it comes before the Lord. It comes, stirs up the Lord of hosts. Secondly, these people were guilty of self-indulgence. Not only had they kept back the wages from the poor, they had used those wages to live in luxury. Verse 5 says, "You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts up in a day of slaughter." They've withheld the wages and they've used them to live lavishly. Self-indulgence. They did not deny themselves anything that they wanted. Anything that their hearts desired, they had. Again, this is kind of disgusting because we look at it and we say, I mean, number one, they should have been taking care of their workers. But then to turn around and use it for self-indulgence is just wicked. But it says they fattened their hearts for the day of slaughter. Now, in the Bible, in the Old Testament, in Isaiah 30, the day of slaughter is a reference to the day of the Lord, a final judgment on the earth. I don't think that's what James is referencing here, though. I don't think he's necessarily, I mean, yes, there is a day of judgment coming, and they're going to answer for this. But I think he's using an illustration here. He's saying they're fattened for the day of slaughter, just as an animal is prepared for the day of slaughter. Does anybody here know what a feedlot is? You know what the feedlot is? On a farm, especially on a cattle farm where you're raising beef, they have what's called the feedlot. And what happens is when the cow is about ready to be shipped off and harvested, they send it to the feedlot, which is basically where they give the cow a lot of food in order to kind of get it fat so it's ready for slaughter. And in fact, some of these cows can not quite double their weight, but I mean significantly add to their weight in the feedlot. That's the point. You give them, you know, high-calorie diet. You just load them up. Now, I don't know what cows think or if they think, but I imagine if you're a cow and you're in the feedlot, you probably think, man, I have arrived in heaven. Doesn't get any better than this. You just sit around and eat and get fat. It's wonderful. And so if you're in the feedlot, you're thinking, man, I've got it made. Well, James is saying, the rich, you're in the feedlot. You're living high. You think things are great. It's wonderful. But you know what? When the day comes, it's not going to be so pleasant. When you go through those one-way doors, you're not coming back. So they have been guilty of defrauding. They're guilty of self-indulgence. And then lastly, guilty of murder. Verse 6, "You have condemned and you have murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you." Now, at this point, you might be thinking to yourself, well, if these day laborers were being so mistreated and so taken advantage of, why didn't they do something about it? Why didn't they take their boss to court, sue him, and get their wages? Well, because that's not how it worked. You see, the courts were skewed in favor of the rich. If you go back in James, to James chapter 2, verse 6, it says, "You have dishonored the poor man. Are not the rich the ones who oppress you, the ones who drag you into court?" So it's not them dragging their bosses into work. It's not them forming a union. No, it's their bosses who are actually dragging them to court. And how does that happen? How does the rich get this verdict in their favor? Well, they've got money. You know, it really helps if you can pay off the judge or if he's your friend and came to your party at your house last night. And so injustice upon injustice. So they condemned, which is kind of a legal term. They've condemned. But it also says they murdered. Now, I think this is literal. I think they really did murder. But I don't think it was a murder by, you know, the rich took a knife and plunged it into the poor. No, I think what it was they withheld wages and they mistreated. And eventually you had families who were starving to death. They didn't directly murder them. But through their actions, through their exploitation, through their mistreatment, they are guilty of those lives. But notice how it ends. He says, "You've murdered the righteous person, the one who is a follower of the Lord. He does not resist you." I want to notice a couple things about this. First of all, I think this is the right response for those who are suffering injustice, not to resist, but to trust themselves to the Lord. Now, it doesn't mean you can never, you know, again, in our system, maybe you can sue someone, or maybe you can, fall back on legal protections. But again, we're going to learn in the next section, James says in verse 7, be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. Be patient. Don't resist. But, I mean, even if they wanted to resist, they couldn't. There was nothing they could do to the rich. But I want you to read between the lines here in verse 6. It says, he does not resist you. But I think there's implied in that there is one who resists you. It may not be the poor people who can't do anything, but the Lord of armies is against you. Now, I know this section is quite a heavy one to read. And maybe you feel okay about it because you say, well, I'm not rich. I don't have to worry about this. I'm not practicing injustice. But here's the list of charges. They defraud, indulge themselves, they murder the innocent. And you'll notice, by the way, I didn't highlight this, but there are three different witnesses against them. It says in verse 3, your corroded wealth will be evidence against you. Then it says their wages cry out against you. That's witness number 2. And then it says the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord. That's witness number 3. So on the testimony of 2 or 3 witnesses, they are found guilty as charged. Now again, hopefully we're not the rich who are oppressing others. But this passage goes on to say quite a bit to those who are oppressed. So we'll pick that up in verse 7 next time. But let's ask ourselves, what applications can we draw from this passage? There's a lot of, by the way, legitimate applications you can draw about wealth and money and riches from this passage. But I think the main focus is not on the riches that they had, but on the injustice they did. So I want us to think about two things in terms of our own lives. First of all, I think this passage encourages us to consider carefully how you treat others. Consider carefully how you treat others. Okay, you're not oppressing people. You're not holding back wages. Is that the only way to commit injustice? Not at all. Maybe we still find ourselves knocking down people to try to get ourselves ahead. You know, maybe we don't commit murder, but we can treat people in contemptible ways. All because we want to try to prepare best for our future. And by the way, this can be true of Christians too. Christians can treat each other in awful ways. We saw that previously in chapter 4, verses 11 and 12, where James said, don't slander one another. Apparently there was some of that going on. So we need to carefully consider how we treat others. When the rich mistreat the poor here, God notices. God steps in. So we can't just ignore, it doesn't matter. Who are they anyways? God cares. Carefully consider how you treat others. And then secondly, I want us to consider fearfully the fate of the ungodly. Now, this passage doesn't use the word hell anywhere in it. But it's pretty clear that there's a hell waiting for these rich who oppress. Weeping and gnashing of teeth, shrieking in terror, their flesh being eaten up like fire. It's a horrifying picture. But I want to also remind us that that's the picture who awaits all the ungodly, not just the rich, but all who reject the goodness of God, all who pursue their own selfish means, all those who would spurn the law of God. There is a terrifying reality of judgment which awaits. So as we read these passages, it should send a shudder through our bodies. What an awful thing this is to fall into the hands of the living God. And yet, there are people in our lives, friends, neighbors, family members we know that are headed for that fearful judgment. May we pray all the more fervently. May we share all the more courageously. May we love all the more boldly. Because we know there is a fearful judgment that awaits all those who are not in Christ Jesus. And that's why when we connected here this morning to our celebration of the Lord's Supper, this really is a wonderful and joyful thing, but it's also a somber thing because we realize we've been rescued from the fearful judgment that we so deserve. So if you'd consider this morning the fearful fate of the ungodly, not just as a matter of trembling fear, but as a motivation for us to share this good news so that they too may find the hope that is found in Jesus.